can be read about in his published books. But what of the man himself, his early life, and the sources of his teaching? At Prince Subahardin's palace, on the Bosphorus, in 1920, J.G. Bennett met and talked with Gurdjieff for the first time. Knowing the countries of his origins, speaking the Turkish languages used by him, John Bennett was able to communicate with Gurdjieff in a unique way and remained in touch with him until Gurdjieff died in 1949. John Bennett made this recording with Rosemary Sands a few months before his sudden death in 1974.
What impression did Gurdjieff make on you at your first meeting with him?
My first meeting of him in June in 1920 was the subject we met on was hypnotism at Prince Subahattin's place in the Bosphorus, and I saw that he knew far more about hypnotism than all the experts I'd learned with, and that he had powers. I've seen since in personal contact that he had really wonderful powers of healing. I owed him a great deal because he healed my own wife when she was dying in 1948, and he did it just across the table. I've seen many healings, but he always kept quiet about his healing powers. He had extraordinary power to influence people. If he chose to use it, nobody could resist him. But he describes in his own third series, in The Life is Real Only Then When I Am, how he came to the conclusion in 1902 that he had to renounce the use of these powers for his personal ends or he'd be lost, and he made a vow that he would never use them except to help people or to further the work. And he kept that vow. This is one reason why he had so many failures, I think, in his personal life. But he did, in 1909, give himself out to be a professional hypnotist or a hypnotic healer, doctor hypnotist, physician, and he practiced that in Tashkent, and he had a great following of people. His family gave me the oldest photograph of him that goes back to 1909. I put it in my book there, where you see him in a frock coat and the young man with all his hair. He shaved his hair off, of course, when he went into a Buddhist lamasery, and kept it and never continued to be without hair for the rest of his life. But at that time, he still had his great shock of black hair. But if you want to know about him just as a human being like the rest of us, he was extremely human. He had a very irascible temper, even violent. He was extremely kind, and he could go to infinite pains to help people who were in real need and be utterly ruthless in dealing with people who were after him with some ulterior motive. He could play a role to perfection, whatever kind of man he wanted to appear to be to the people who visited him. He would be that man, and they would know no other. We often used to say about Gurdjieff that there were as many Gurdjieffs as there were people who went to talk to him. No two people would he give exactly the same report of who he was and what impression he made on them. But if you want to know something about him, his appearance, he was short, and you never thought he was short. He was immensely broad. He had a great dome of a head and strange eyes. The two eyes were different, and you never knew quite who was looking at you. He himself used to talk about looking at a person out of the left eye, and he looked at you quite differently according to which eye he looked through. You know, the moments when he could change instantaneously. Hundreds of times I've sat next to him at his ritual meals, as being director, and I've been there within inches of him, and I could feel the warmth and kindliness. Then I would perhaps make a faux pas, or something would change, and suddenly he would be ice, and you could feel the icy waves coming from him, the complete rejection. And he could do this in a moment. I've seen him shouting and swearing and terrifying, his swick coming out on his forehead with his anger at somebody, and a really terrifying display, and absolutely instantaneously, in a moment, it would all go, broad smile would come out over his face, and he'd say, "You see, she well educated," because she didn't react to what he was doing. And now this power not only to act, but instantaneously to change the part he was acting, made it extremely disconcerting for people who saw relatively little of him.
I'd like to take you back to your research on Gurdjieff's boyhood and origins.
You have to know that part of the world to appreciate it. I've lived many years in the Levant, and I've known many Greek and Armenian friends, and I've known people, Tatars and Russians, and even the Yazidis and Gypsies. It was an extraordinary environment. You must understand that the towns of Alexandropol and Kars, where he was born and brought up, were the crossroads. They were part through which one invasion after another came from the east to the west. They usually stopped short at the great mountains that lead up into Erzurum, and therefore Kars has again and again been a battlefield thousands, literally thousands of years. And for a long time, Gurdjieff's own race, the Armenians, were in command of that crossroads. And he was, I would have said, primarily an Armenian. His mother was Armenian. His father was Greek. Greek from Cappadocia. I met his mother. I never met his father, who was killed, massacred by the Turkish invasion in 1920 when I was in Constantinople, or just before Gurdjieff came there himself. He was not killed in 20. He was killed in the earlier Turkish invasion of 1918, just immediately after the October Revolution. He was born at the time of the siege of Kars in the Russo-Turkish War of 1877. He was actually born just before the Russians took Kars, and he was brought up, therefore, in the aftermath of a war. His family moved after the Russian army and found place where they could settle. Thousands of Greeks and Armenians returned to that part of the world. Hundreds of thousands of Turks left it. You understand, that's an extraordinary environment. The Russians were only just beginning to make their presence felt. Russian language had hardly begun to be used, but Gurdjieff did go to the Russian town school in Kars. I visited the school myself. It's still standing there. And he lived just under the shelter of the fortress cathedral at Kars, the Russian fortress cathedral, in a very strange way of life. Unless you go there, you can hardly believe it. There, the old houses are all underground, and the roofs of the houses are continuous, so that you walk over them, as they've done. It's an extraordinary thing to see, as they've done for 8,000 years. The houses were just the same at Çatalhöyük in the 6th millennium BC. And Gurdjieff was brought up in this extraordinarily primitive, ancient environment with the influences, very ancient influences all around him. And then he came in contact with, after all, very sophisticated Russian culture. And he became enormously interested in science, in physiology, in psychology particularly, and he learned such a lot. He clearly was of an extraordinary precocity that when he was already 11 years old, he was beginning to search for himself, so that his childhood really effectively finished in 1888 when he was 11. He says so himself. He made his first considerable journey right across Asia Minor to Turkey, to Istanbul in 1888. You saw these young Greek and Armenian boys at 11 and 12. They were so mature, and Gurdjieff was probably far more mature than so. You mustn't be astonished that he was already an independent, earning his own living at 11 years old, and able to travel and get to know people. This accounts for one of the difficulties in assessing his age. For a long time, I couldn't believe that he was born in 1877. He himself spoke of himself as being much older, and it seemed impossible. I said he must have been born in 1872, and he was not 11, but 16. But I've seen his passports, and I've seen that his family kindly showed me all the documents that were preserved, and they all show his birth in December 1877. And then after, from 11 years onwards, he travelled and travelled and travelled. About his time in Tibet, it's more difficult. That he knew Tibetan, that I could, that I verified for myself by that I know little Tibetan. And he spoke explicitly, not only in his books, but in talking with us about having gone to Tibet and of the peculiar thing that happened at the Tibetan frontier when his pay presented his Russian pass and they mistook it and they have no G, no guttural G in Tibetan, and so they transliterated him as Dorjev instead of Gurdjieff, and hence all those misunderstandings as to whether he was the Lama Dorjev, that the famous man of the Young Husband expedition who was intermediary between the Dalai Lama and the Tsar.
Do you think he was?
No. There are photographs extant of Dorjev in the Russian papers, and he was not. He was a Mongol. That's why he's a name. But that Gurdjieff probably was able, because he was called Dorjev, to get many advantages and have access to lamasseries that he couldn't have visited otherwise, that I think is very probable. And he was very astute about doing that sort of thing. I know that he was able to enter because from the movements and music and some of the teachings that he's got based on tantric Buddhism that are not at all, not at that time accessible. It's only since the Tibetans had to leave their country. That gives you at least a bit of his background. He came from two races, Greek and Armenian. He was under many influences, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Gypsies, various little-known sects of that part of the world, like the Yazidis and the Ahli Haq, the people of the truth. And the result of it was that he had an insight into many traditions when he was still a boy, which would have been very difficult for a European child, or for people from India, or Persia, where the traditions are much more established. In that part of the world, there was just a melting pot of traditions. So in a way, although the conditions of his birth were very unfavorable, they were the only conditions that could possibly have given him this extraordinary early insight into the diversity of traditions, which enormously interested him, and his great thing was to try to find what was the root of all the traditions.
How did he manage to finance these long travels?
It doesn't cost much to travel in the East. He traveled a good deal by himself. And sometimes he spoke of it as being really very largely a solitary search, but he also referred to a group that was formed when he was about 14 years old, which he joined as a boy. Through contact with the Russian prince, and this group, which gave themselves the name Seekers of the Truth, he describes three or four expeditions that he went with them. Now, the Prince Lubovetsky was himself a very rich man, and undoubtedly they financed the travels, and even Gurdjieff was paid to go with them as interpreter and guide and so on. But when he traveled alone, he travelled just, as they say, off the land. He would find ways of making money wherever he went. He was extraordinarily adroit at doing that. He wouldn't need any finance. mean, even I have travelled in the East without money, and it's not a difficult thing to do. But he could do infinitely more. There was no problem for him. Even when he was in a big group, the Seekers of the Truth, the older members of the group financed it. When it was alone, he just travelled making his money as he went, and when he was out of money, he'd stop for a couple of months in a place and make money and then go on.
You said earlier that it was general for Armenian boys of 11 years old to travel, but what were the further motivations for Gurdjieff's journeys?
You have to understand that all young people have questions, and their questions are not answered by their parents and teachers. Many of them would like to go out and find the answers for themselves. I'm sure that this is true for, especially for the young people of the present time. They're just not satisfied with the answers that are given to them, and he wasn't satisfied. He saw extraordinary things happening in front of him. Miracles like rain being brought on by a wonder-working icon, miraculous cure of a girl dying of TB by drinking rose horse soup prescribed by the Virgin Mary in a vision, all sorts of strange things like this, and the peculiar powers that some people like the Yazidis, the so-called devil worshippers of Kurdistan, possess, and nobody could explain it to him. Nor could he feel that there was any sense in the way that people were living. He was very oppressed by the artificiality and falseness of the social life around the Russian garrison, by the absurd antics of his own peoples trying to ingratiate themselves with the Russians, and he wanted to know what life was about. And this question, I'm sure, was his obsessive question: what is the sense and meaning of life on the earth, and of human life in particular? This appears over and over again in his writing. I must know what life's about. If I can't get it from the people that I know, and if I can't get it from books, then I must go on until I find people who can give me an answer. And it was this search for someone or some group somewhere who knew something. He also became convinced that much more had been known in the past, but it was badly recorded in books, and he felt that somewhere there would be still preserved traditions. It was in search of that. But not only in people, he spent a long time in Egypt trying to decipher the secrets of the pyramids, and in Babylon particularly, where he became more and more convinced that in old Babylon the great knowledge had existed which had since been lost and which he was searching for. He had traces that there had existed a secret society, the Sarmaan Society, founded long, long way back in the time of Sargon the Great, and that this society, he convinced, somewhere still existed. And he and an Armenian friend of his, Bogosyan, went in search of it, and they found traces. In the end, he found many things, but if you are asking the motive of his search, it was undoubtedly that, somehow or other and somewhere, to find people who could give him some clue to this question: what is the sense and meaning of life on the earth? I think somewhere about 1908 he finally came across the source that he was looking for, that is the Sarmaan Society in Turkestan, somewhere in the not far from Bukhara, and probably in the great caves that there are north of the Sirdarya River.
Could you explain more about the Sarmaan Society?
Well, the Sarmaan Society is another big piece of research. It's beating it together from various sources. According to Gurdjieff, the Sarmaan Society was an esoteric group that has existed for 4,500 years, as I said, having been founded at the time of Sargon the Great, of Hammurabi, the lawgiver, and having moved to Baghdad, to Babylon, at about the 1500 BC, and remaining there until the time of Zoroaster, having some intimate connection with Zoroaster, in some way feeding into Zoroaster, and then having gone to the north, having spent some time at the near the sources of the Tigris at Mosul, finally withdrew up into Central Asia. And that's what Gurdjieff was on, trying to find, and according to his own account, which he describes in meetings with remarkable men, he came across them. He doesn't date it there, but I had from other sources to reach the conclusion that it was about 1908. Now, I want you to understand that our knowledge of the Sarman Society comes almost entirely, in the first place, from Gurdjieff himself, both from his own books and from many references in conversations with me and with other pupils, and more recently from Idris Shah and from people who have written books associated with Idris Shah, who have been themselves in contact with the Sarman Society and have given a picture of it very similar to the picture which Gurdjieff gave. I myself have investigated the origins of the Sarman Society as thoroughly as I could, and have come to the conclusion that such a brotherhood has existed and probably still exists to this day, and that Gurdjieff was in contact with them, and that he learned some of the most important parts of his own system, or ideas as he called them, from this brotherhood. I don't think it's likely that this brotherhood was in the position of being Gurdjieff's teacher. He referred to his teacher as an individual rather than as a brotherhood. He referred to a brotherhood as one with which he worked very closely and to which he sent certain special pupils for advanced training. This may well have been the Sarman Society. I think that the Sarman Society knew that he intended to launch ideas, many of which originated from them, and that they were willing that he should do so, but they regarded him more as a pioneer working on his own with their supervision, rather than as a missionary specifically sent by them.
What do you think was the most important thing he learned there?
With the Sarman Society, he first of all satisfied himself that there was a living tradition. The perennial philosophy was actually embodied in people. And this has been the great search of many, you know. You know, Aldous Huxley's perennial philosophy and many others, that all the indirect evidence that there has been a tradition, and all people like René Guénon and so on, but I don't believe that many people from the West have actually met the living tradition as he did, and most of them have never returned. His friend remained there and didn't wish to return, and none of them. But he found there the knowledge of certain laws which he knew existed, but which he'd never been able to get fully, what he called later the laws of threefoldness and sevenfoldness. He found certain secrets as regards the transformation of man, certain predictions as regards the future of the human race, and the role of the masters of the schools in preparing the future, and he felt that his task was to go and open the way.
You've been talking about Gurdjieff's search. At what stage did he begin to give out the knowledge he had acquired?
So far as I can make out, I've had enormous difficulty in reconstructing his life. It has been really one of the most fascinating pieces of research I've ever undertaken. I had to study a great deal of the topography of the Central Asia and the history of it, and all his own writings and everything that I could remember of what he'd said in conversation, and just occasionally little documents that he put out, like the prospectus of the institute that he started in Turkey, in Istanbul, in 1920. And he gave me a copy of this prospectus and said that he had started it all in Tashkent before the war in 1909, and that really gave me the clue to putting the various things together. From 1909 to 1911 or 12, he remained in Asia. Then he decided that he'd have to do it on his own. Before he started to organize something of his own, when he joined various movements, like the Theosophical Society and so on, it was very flourishing in those days, that was after Blavatsky, of course, and he tried to find people with whom he'd be able to work in that way. And of course he had this remarkable knowledge that he'd acquired in the course of his travels, and perhaps mostly with his visits to these special centers like the Sarman Society and Ajgan and others. He was not able to find at that time people who really had the kind of understanding or the determination to follow him. I mean, he set very high standards in that way, and his group of seekers of the truth, which by that time had disbanded, were people of great determination, and he said he would, and also that he was finding in these the Theosophical Society and so on, people rather of one type, of that kind of theoretical searcher. And therefore he thought he must set up his own institute. And the earliest moment he went to Russia, went to Moscow, and he started it there. He was undoubtedly brought up to Petersburg. He did meet people connected with the imperial court. I'm pretty confident he was personally presented to the Tsar, and somewhere at that time he met his wife, a very Polish lady, Madame Ostrowska, very beautiful and remarkable woman. I first saw her in 1920 in Istanbul, and he loved her dearly. And she died of cancer in 1926. That was his great tragedy, that he was not able, as he'd hoped he would be able to cure her. But he never, she had no children. So he's only got his nephews and nieces of his own blood left there, except his natural children, of course.
But he had to leave Moscow.
With the October Revolution, he had to get away from, they went down to the Caucasus. He remained there for a couple of years, and then he saw that everything was going to collapse in the Caucasus. The Georgian government was going to break down, and he decided to come to Turkey. That's when I personally first heard of him, you see. It was in the middle of 1920. It was then that I heard of him in that strange way, in my job as I was the chief of the intelligence for the Army of the Black Sea, on the political side. I used to get all the time dispatches from India as to people that had to be watched who were coming out, and I simply got a dispatch saying a very dangerous Russian agent by name George Gurdjieff was arriving in Istanbul. Would I keep an eye on him? That's the first I ever heard of him. And quite independently of that, I was invited by my very dear friend Prince Sabahiddin, who was nephew of the Sultan, to go and visit him and meet a man. And it turned out it was Gurdjieff, whom Sultan, Prince had known before the war, before 1914. That's how my first personal contact with him. I've no doubt at all that Gurdjieff was in fact an agent of the Tsarist government. I think that's how he was able to travel, how he was able to get into Tibet, how he had all sorts of facilities given him. You were asking me about his travels. He was partly facilitated, I think, by that, the Russian government. He does hint of this in his own book, Meetings with Remarkable Men, that he was quite willing to take on political assignments if that would get him to places he wanted to visit. I mean, he regarded as any means that would legally get him to a place as one to be adopted.
People have said that he was also a Marxist agent.
He himself did say, whether it's true or not, I have no means of knowing, that he actually was at the seminary with Stalin, and that he'd known Stalin as a boy. It seems to me highly improbable, but I've heard him say it myself several times. But that he... I'm reasonably satisfied. No, I'm more than satisfied. I don't believe for a moment he was ever an agent of the communist government of Russia, because he left Russia before Georgia turned communist. At the time he left Georgia, July 1920, there was still the Social Democratic government in Georgia.
Then he went to Istanbul. Why did he come further west? Was it for ideological reasons, or did he have to flee?
No, he did not have to flee. He could certainly have stayed in Istanbul. He had plenty of support there. Istanbul had an enormous Greek and Armenian population, and he could have stayed there, and he would have kept a link with his homeland. After all, he was only a day's journey from the Kasp, where his mother still was. Or not in not Kars, but Alexandropol. I think that he made the great decision that he had to go to the West because he thought his work would best be appreciated and he'd do the most useful work there. And I think that he was convinced that the esoteric tradition was going to flower in the West, and that it was his mission to sow the seeds, and that's what he came to the West. If that's what you mean by ideological, yes, I would say that is so.
We know that when he came to England, the Home Office refused permission for him to stay here.
Yes, but I think that was more because he was a Russian agent. You know, we make a sharp distinction between Tsarists and communists, but Russia is Russia, and Russia for a long time been intent upon controlling the Central Asia, and we at that time, after all, were still the British Empire, and we did not want the Russians to control Central Asia, which we also had some eye on at that time. So there was this enormous conflict between British Raj and the Russian Empire. Therefore, anyone who would be acting for the Russians would, even after the collapse of the Tsarist regime, still be looked upon as someone to be watched.
So he moved on.
He went to Berlin first, and then he came to London, then he went to Paris.
Did he then move nearer to the Christian faith?
Well, he was brought up as a Christian. He was, for the time, even thinking of entering the priesthood. He was always very outspoken in his criticism of institutional religion, Christian, Muslim, any. He always said that the church had completely destroyed the original message of Christ, and that to understand, one had to think outside the categories of Christian dogma in order to understand what Christ really stood for. That he was very firm about. He always regarded Christianity as essentially the truth. In one of the lectures I heard him give at the Prairie in 1923, he said, "The aim of my institute is to enable people to be Christians." He said, "You must understand that people, there are three kinds of people. There are those who think they're Christians and don't know anything about it. There are those who really want to be Christians. And there are people who are able to be Christians. My job is to get the people who want to be Christians and show them how they can be Christians." I mean, that was the way he spoke about it. But you must understand, he was very much at home with Islam. A great many of his teachers had been Sufis. He'd met with Sufi brotherhoods in Oh, tarikat in different parts, right, from Turkey, right away through to Xinjiang, to Chinese Turkestan.
When he got to the West, how did he manage to collect groups of people around him?
Well, he had this remarkable man, P.D. Uspensky, whom he met in 1915 in Moscow. Then he met Alexander Salzman, the great stage designer, about the same time, and Hartmann, the composer and friend of Scriabin. They're quite outstandingly interesting people, and of course people like that would have others following them. Then when he came to Turkey, he met some people there. When he came to England, Uspensky had preceded him. He'd come here through Lady Rothermere, as everyone knows. And Uspensky had two main groups, two main sources. One were the psychoanalysts, the people, the Jungians, who were looking beyond psychoanalysis. They were Dr. Modest. No, Nickel wasn't in it at the very first, but Raj and several other. Then Nickel soon afterwards joined. So there were that group, and then there were the theosophists. I remember particularly Maud Hoffman and the man who wrote the Fragments of a Faith Forgotten, G.R.S. Mead. You know, those people came from that group, and that was where Uspensky got his people. And they in turn brought in some quite influential and some very rich people who helped Gurdjieff to found his institute. Gurdjieff's institute in Paris depended very much upon English money. He had very little support from the French. They couldn't understand what he was after. He had all his imprecision and his contradictoriness and so on was very alien to the Gallic mind, but much more acceptable to ours.
What do you think is his standing in the world of ideas today?
Like most great innovators, he dropped out of sight after his death, and there's now a growth of interest, which is especially in the United States quite extraordinary, and then a great number of imitators and people who never met him, never even met one of his own personal pupils, are setting themselves up to teach his teaching and basing themselves on what they find in books, so that there are literally tens of thousands of people interested in Gurdjieff's work. You must realize that the Gurdjieff followers are not a mass movement. There are probably all over the world between 8,000 and 10,000 people who are specifically regarding themselves as followers of Gurdjieff's ideas. Only perhaps a third of these are organized with pupils of Gurdjieff at the head, but many people have become interested in Gurdjieff's ideas. I know myself of quite a large number of American universities where they have courses on Gurdjieff and also Uspensky's ideas. I get letters from professors asking me questions and referring to various books, and I, judging from this, I think that the interest is considerable. I'm not mentioning any names, but there's one person whom I would like to refer to, and that is Dr. Fritz Schumacher, the author of the book on intermediate technology. He came in contact with Gurdjieff's ideas about 25 years ago, not long after Gurdjieff died, and I myself had many meetings with him at that time. He's one of the world's greatest working economists. He did a great deal to establish the successful running decentralization of the National Coal Board with Lord Robins in this country, and afterwards was economic advisor to the government of Burma. He undoubtedly has grasped some of the basic ideas of Gurdjieff's teaching, particularly as they affect ecology and the relationship of man to nature. And I think that with his work and the work of quite a number of other people who are similarly inspired by Gurdjieff's doctrine of reciprocal maintenance, are playing a quite important part in preparing the way for a new kind of society here, a society based on decentralization and a quite different connection between man and nature. That is just what Gurdjieff constantly was teaching us as being necessary if man was to survive on this earth. Of course, of psychologists also, there are many, and Gurdjieff's psychology is taught by professors in not only in Europe and America, but also in Eastern countries. I know in the University of Sindh, my friend Professor Haliputta gives courses in Gurdjieff's psychology. And so I think that one can say that Gurdjieff's ideas are spreading. They are not written about very much in books, but people are teaching them, applying them in practice, and that to an increasing extent. But I think it's important here to make a distinction between two attitudes toward any kind of teaching, and very much to Gurdjieff's. That is what I would call the esoteric attitude and the open attitude. The esoteric view is that the traditional teaching is essentially secret. It is for the few. It is not to be divulged to the profane, and that it is the duty of those to whom it's entrusted to preserve it for the future. And they essentially look upon themselves as preservers, and they only make available what is required at any given time. And there is, of course, another aspect of the esoteric view, and that is that only few are capable of transfer following the path, that this doctrine of election can be pushed to extreme, that many are called but few are chosen can be interpreted to mean that few are very few. This is the real extreme esoteric view, and it's a very comforting view. I mean, if you once feel you're inside, it's lovely to be able to look out and look up at all the cohorts of the damned who will never get there. But the other, that is the extreme esoteric and rather egoistic attitude, I think. But there's another much more serious and much more valid thing, and that is that teaching can so easily be distorted that one has to be very careful not to divulge it to people who will be liable to misuse it, especially if the teaching is not only theoretical but contains practical sources of power and influence over people. The other view is that there are times when the teaching is needed, and then it comes out into the open. This is what's sometimes called the fourth way, that when the moment comes that the world needs it, it then comes out. I believe myself that Gurdjieff himself a believer in the open way. I remember I saw a great deal of him in the last part of his life, and he was constantly speaking about the publication of his books and our duty to spread them as widely as possible. I remember once I went at the invitation of Dr. Montessori to give a lecture about Gurdjieff at a conference of hers in San Remo, and it was put on the Italian radio, and I went back to Paris and told him, and he was beaming. He said, "Ha! I think Pope Rome will have heard this now, and perhaps Pope Rome will invite me to Rome. One day everyone will be talking about this teaching," and so on. I don't think he was entirely play-acting in doing that. I think he really did want, I believe he held on to life when he was dying and and really overdue to die, a completely shattered body, until he was assured beyond doubt that his book would be published. I remember taking the proofs to him in Paris, and he saying, "Now I am satisfied." And I think that he wanted to see his teaching very widely spread. This is the reason I am trying to follow that line myself. And at the same time, I'm also very well aware of the importance of preserving it intact and keeping it from being adulterated, so that both the esoteric and the open require one another. They're really complementary to one another, the unmanifested and the manifested, the arupa and the rupa, as the Indians say. And if you ask me what I think that there's something so powerful in certain of Gurdjieff's ideas that they are going to play a really important part in the reconstruction of society that's got to come in the next 20, 30, 50 years. I think he has a really important contribution toward that I and my friends are working to make his contribution actually available in workable form.
What form do you think that contribution could take?
I think it is to show that it's possible to set up a society based on these laws of 3 and 7, based upon a sound psychology, and above all based on what Gurdjieff called the principle of reciprocal maintenance. This was his really great contribution. The belief that everything that exists not only depends upon other things, but has also to maintain them in turn, so that we men depend upon plant and animal life and mineral and this planet, and we have an obligation ourselves to serve in our turn. The meaning that the answer to his question, what's the sense and aim of existence on the earth, is that we people have the obligation to serve life on this earth, to contribute towards the evolution of life and towards the evolution of the whole of this solar system, and that we can do this by what he calls conscious labor and intentional suffering, his great phrase being part of duty, and that the way we live our lives, the way we relate to one another, is the means for us to contribute to the evolution of life, that we have to abandon this grasping, self-seeking attitude that man's got towards nature, feeling that we can entitled to dominate and to destroy as it suits us, and we have to change over to an attitude of service towards nature.
John Bennett was talking to Rosemary Sands about Gurdjieff the man. It was recorded at John Bennett's home in the west of England shortly before his sudden death in 1974, and was made exclusively for Seminar Cassette.